Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedies in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Mark Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedies in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedies in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremediesinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict predecided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. But if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look at these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if the remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we can dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, I want to thank you for that wonderful disclaimer. Ladies and gentlemen, those disclaimers are very, very important. In the near 30 years that I've been marketing information providers that assist you in the things that you need to have assistance in and teach you the things that you need to know, I've never even had an investigator, never mind a prosecutor, get in touch with me with regards to practicing law without a license. I appreciate you storming through that with us. Tonight, before we bring PJ on, I want to start sharing with you the benefits of allodial title on the land. And it's my premise that this is only available to those people who have corrected their status. Others have been attempting to hold their land in allodial title. That's the highest title that you can possibly have on your land. But the key, in my opinion, is to having a citizen of one of the freely associated compact states doing this as opposed to a federal citizen, which has really no standing in law to speak of in the good sense. To begin this article, it says, we the people have the inalienable right in this free republic as American nationals or as sovereign state citizens to acquire, utilize, and own property. We the people have the inalienable right to have and hold the property free and clear of government liens and encumbrances. These rights have not been abridged, although they have come under attack by the government and the principal creditors controlling the government. But we the people must understand not only our rights, but how to acquire and utilize and own property as it was intended by our founding fathers and guaranteed in the United States of America. We the people must understand not only the nature of money, but the political, economic, and legal systems to be able to claim our rights to acquire and own land. You cannot trust the government, the corporations, the media, or the education systems to educate you or fully disclose honest information about your property rights. One of the major motivators of the first American Revolution was the issue of allodial rights to land, free and clear of the liens and encumbrances of the King of England. The American people desired to acquire, utilize, and own their own land without interference from any government, including the government of the United States of America. And as a result of generations of constructive fraud perpetuated against the American people and the peoples of the world, for that matter, we've been conned into believing we are owning property when, in fact, by law, we're only in possession of the property, utilizing it as a renter or tenant, as they would. So long as we pay our rent, that is the mortgages, and get our licenses and pay the fees and have it insured and regulated and zoned and permitted, we're still allowed to remain in this possession. But as soon as we exercise what we believe is our sovereign right to do as we please with our private property, providing we don't damage or injure another or their property, we often get slam dunked by a fine, eviction, or foreclosure. We must learn about allodial titles, land patents, deeds, and conveyances to assert our sovereign right to private property. An allodial title was bestowed by law upon the land with unalienability forever. No government, no agency, no bank, or other sovereign power could place a lien, attachment, or encumbrance on land held in the allodial state. An allodial title is derived from the original federal land patent. Land patents are still today the highest evidence of title and have never been refuted by any court of competent jurisdiction. All federal land patents flow from the treaty, that is, the Oregon Treaty or other treaties. Therefore, no state, private banking corporation, or other federal agency can effectively challenge the superiority of title to landholders who have perfected their land patent. With an updated land patent brought forward in your name, you can hold the rights and the title to the land as a sovereign, as a state citizen. Be very careful that this is a distinct from the equitable interest, the title and deed. Property tax attaches to the equitable title and interest in the property and real estate through a hidden federal lien. If the property and real estate is recorded with a deed, that is, the trust deed or warranty deed or quitclaim deed at the county recorder's office, then it's trust property executed and managed by the legal owners, that is, the county, the state, and the federal United States government, the corporations, and its principal creditors. Thus, they are the legal owners of the recorded property and real estate, and they can require you, the tenant, to get building permits, abide by zoning restrictions and other statutory regulations, including environmental laws, because it's not your property or real estate. Most Americans are simply glorified tenants on what they erroneously believe is their property and real estate. You need to wake up, America. The original letters of patent were from the King of England, or the King of Spain, as it applies here in Florida. And this is the record of these land patents in the state archives and the county courthouses. Under English law, all realty, that is real estate, was owned by the sovereign, and from the crown, all titles flow. Give me a minute here. There we go. All federal land patents flow from treaty rights and hold superior title to land. After the Declaration of Independence of 1776, the American Revolution, and the Treaty of Peace with Great Britain, 1783, the American people became complete, sovereign, freeholders in the land with the same prerogative as the king. The king had no further claim to the land and could not tax or otherwise encumber it. The land patent is the only evidence of title to land. Land patents are derived from the treaties and enabling acts of the Congress under the signature of the President of the United States of America when each state entered the Union. Land patents are stare decisis. It's res judicata. It's already well-settled law and decided. For example, railroad land granted and patented in the late 1800s is still sovereign today. Building codes and local zoning ordinances do not apply to railroad property. Railroad patents were also issued by a special act of Congress. It was called the Railroad Grants Acts, granting alternating sections of land in each township, and they are still the largest landowner in America. During the times of the Articles of Confederation, when our colonies were translating into sovereign states, the sovereign state republics would not appropriate any lands to the federal government. They didn't want to relinquish any of their sovereignty to this new government. And finally, the states relented, and unappropriated lands were given to the federal government to distribute to the people on the condition that they would grant full allodial title. A land patent office was established to distribute these unappropriated lands by grant to the people. The state has no authority over this land. The right and title is held by the United States. All right and title to the unappropriated land was held to the disposition of the United States government to be granted, not sold, but granted to the people. This is how land comes to the people. It's the Enabling Acts. Each state republic agreed and declared that they would give up all right and title to this land. The state has no authority over the land, except there is an exception, Texas. Hello, Texas. Except for Texas, which never gave up its lands or military. So the lands is the state patent office, and its military is its Texas Rangers. It never gave them up to the federal government. It's still a free and independent sovereign state. The federal United States government became the trustees with the power of attorney over the disbursement of the land to the people. Land patents are issued and theoretically passed between sovereigns. That's why we talk about correcting your status. These are executed by persons and private corporations without these sovereign powers. Through various acts of Congress, land was made available for granting, not selling, but for granting, and the American people became the recipient of those land grants. Land patents are the first conveyance of title ownership to land. One of the earliest laws for granting land patents was passed by Congress April 24, 1820. It was also how the American people qualified to become a sovereign state citizen and electors in their respective state republics. Landowners are the only authority in the United States of America with the power to elect public officials of the government at every level, county, state, and federal. The whole system of granting land worked well until the Western state republics, entering into the post-Civil War Union, surrendered unappropriated lands to the federal United States government that did not get distributed to the people. Large portions of the West were not distributed to the people, but it was federal land or distributed to the states. PJ talks about this when he talks about how, for instance, I think it says Connecticut or Rhode Island has like 0.4% of its land mass that's actually United States government land, but Nevada, it's like 84%. Anyways, this was a flagrant violation of the principles upon which America was founded. So who has all the land in America? If the state doesn't have any authority over the land and the United States government corporation can't own the land, then who has the land? We the people still have all the land in America. The land is ours and hasn't gone anywhere. The rights and titles haven't been bought or sold. They are not for sale. By the law of the land, the people are still holding the rights and titles to every square inch of land in the United States of America. And we, the people, must reclaim what is ours and to let's return to the better half what belongs to the Native Americans. What has been bought and sold is the real estate, the equitable interest in property, to the buildings, to the improvements, to the equipment that occupies the space above the land, but not the land itself. This is evidenced in the land patent, even in the deeds and title insurance contracts. Title insurance excludes coverage for the land patent. They cannot and will not insure you against a claim for the right and title to the land itself. The warranty deed grants the land. It doesn't sell the land, it grants the land and sells the property or the real estate. The United States government corporation may not own any land, but it does have equitable interest in lots of real estate. You cannot buy land. You cannot sell land. As a sovereign state citizen, it's yours inheritance since the original 13 colonies formed the United States of America and each additional state republic entered the Union. Full payment is already made in the land patent and all subsequent assignments. The registration and fees in the securing of a land patent were paid to the Surveyor General. It was like $1.25 an acre or $2.25 an acre for a mining claim. This was not the purchase of the land. The land patent speaks plainly, quote, to give and grant, not sell, unto, then your name, and heirs and assigns forever, end quote. To grant is to give freely. It's not to purchase. All right and title to land is conveyed by assignment, gift, or grant directly from the land patent. Land patent rights flow from treaty and enabling acts by way of power of attorney. to an individual landholder, who in turn gives, grants, and assigns the land patents to his heirs and assigns. Freeholders, that is, freehold land, is beholden to no one. Possession is still 9/10 of the law. Caveat emptor, buyer beware. You have 7 years to perfect a claim against land. If notice is duly given and no one contests your claim, it's yours after 7 years. That's the fistful of dirt doctrine. Permission to grow your own crops as a tenant is in effect an assignment by the landowner if you claim your landownment. Appurtenances, that which belongs to something else, an adjunct or appendage, that which passes as incidenta, as a right of way or other easement of land. We've been selling property, real estate, and equitable interest for generations and abandoning the right and title to land. Right and title to land is well established in law. All you need to do in law is to prove that your name is the heir or assigned to that original land patent. The original land patent office is now known as the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, which consisted of government land officers. Records of the original land patents are kept there. Perfecting an allodial title requires updating the original land patent and rewriting the legal description for the land into meets and bounds. Those of you that have had conversations with me over the years, when we talk about land, I always talk in terms of meets and bounds. That's the measurements of the original surveyor general. Research the abstracts of title, make a claim, and bring the title forward minus any exclusions, that is easements. Update and record your land patent in the great book at the county recorder's office, because bringing forth the true title is pursuant to the common law, and you must be a sovereign state citizen to claim the rights and title to this land. This is distinct from any action to land. This is distinct from any actions relating to the equitable title and any liens or encumbrances attached thereof. Land patent processes update the original land patent with the legal descriptions of your parcel in meets and bounds. Research the abstract title. Make a claim as an heir or a sovereign, and bring the title forward minus any exclusions. Re-record the undated land patent at the county recorder's office in the great update land patent pair as an heir or an assignment. In the de jure United States of America and under the common law, the land patent is the highest evidence of title for the sovereign American state citizen, evidence of allodial title and true ownership. But in a bankrupt, de facto, federal United States, inhabited by U.S. citizens and directed by its creditors under admiralty law, the land patent is collaterally hypothecated against the debt which has been fraudulently transferred to the international bankers. There is a hidden federal lien on all property and real estate in the federal United States because of the federal debt to the International Monetary Fund. This federal lien is not attached to the land, but it is attached to the property and the real estate situated right above the land. It is assessed and collected through property taxes. Discover how much federal debt is attached to your property and your real estate by writing the Department of the Interior and requesting an accounting of what portion of the federal debt is attached to your property. To motivate them, tell them that you want to pay off the debt in full. Borrowing the Federal Reserve notes, if necessary, to discharge the debt in full, or offering to pay the debt in full, gold and silver. They'll refuse to accept the gold and silver, by the way. So now you can sue the title insurance company for trouble damages for not revealing the hidden federal lien when you purchased the property to begin with and the real estate. They failed to perform on their end of the contract, and they will likely settle out of court. It's half past the hour now, and I don't want to encroach on really PJ's time here. We'll pick this up again next week when we talk about the deed is a trust instrument. So let's go back now to PJ and share with him, or have him share with us, what's on his mind this week. Hopefully what we just talked about with land patents might be a bully pulpit for him, but he's free to go wherever he likes with it. Go ahead, PJ.
Yes, I'm currently considering establishing a land patent on one of my pieces of property that has a house on it. And I remember researching this years back. Whenever I challenged property taxes, I would just go into district court and challenge it there. I never pushed to get a land patent. But I've come to meet individuals that claim that it's extremely important to have evidence of the land patent, have certified copies of it and so forth, and bring it forward. One thing I noticed when I was doing research I was raised in Nebraska, I looked at the original Constitution. There's two constitutions that were operating on Nebraska soil, in a sense. One was the original Constitution that allowed Nebraska to enter the first statehood under the United States. And in that original Constitution, it says the land shall be owned by ultimate title, by the individuals. It says ultimate title. And then when the railroads started pushing across the country, I think every state created a new constitution to deal with the railroads predominantly. That's what the history books were telling me when I was studying up on it. So they rewrote this new constitution for the individual states. And I would lay these constitutions side by side, and they're almost completely identical until you get to the areas of ultimate title and another area I remember them not being the same is the one had borders and the other one did not have borders. So the first one had a description of the borders throughout the exterior of what we would call Nebraska. And the other constitution didn't have those. And I didn't really understand why. But corporations do not have borders. Corporate charters for corporations do not have borders. Go look at one. You'll never see a border on McDonald's restaurants in their state charters. But this charter that came from the United States to initiate statehood of Nebraska did have a border. I think that's pretty telling. They try to hide that original constitution. It's quite difficult to actually find, and it's difficult to get. Many states will not even give you a certified copy of it anymore. So they don't want people bringing that evidence into the U.S. courtrooms. For example, the railroads in Nebraska were given 10% of the Nebraska land. That's a lot of land. So most of the railroad, the Union Pacific, when it came in, they were building a railroad straight through Nebraska, east and west. And they had I think it was a 10-mile to the right of the railroad and 10 miles to the left of the railroad, all the way through the state. Can you imagine owning that land nowadays? A lot of that land is $10,000 an acre. The tens and hundreds of thousands of acres that the railroad was given. Now, the railroad was given that land so that they could sell it off piece by piece as the land became the most valuable land in the state because of the railroad. So people would pay good money for that because they knew a city was going to be developed there in many places. They had access to the railroad. Nothing else was really moving anything of volume other than wagons and barges and so forth. So, but a lot of it was used by barges, and even today by barges. People don't realize that barges today carry more material than the trucking industry. That's a lot of material. A lot of this material that the barges carry is in the liquid form, petroleum, fertilizers, things like that. If you ever go to Texas and get on one of their barge highways and watch the barges go by, they are one after another for miles and miles an hour, miles and miles and miles spaced apart. They're usually spaced apart about a quarter mile so they don't run into each other if somebody has trouble. And there is day and night. Those things are running. And Christmas Day, you'll see barges running. They do not stop. One thing we need to remember is you cannot own land in the United States because the United States owns that land that is in the United States that is considered federal lands, public lands, state lands. But that only consists of 25% of the lands in America. The other percentage of the land, 75%, is owned by the private sector. And you do not have total right over that land either, because try to sell that land to a foreigner. You can't do it. You cannot give a foreigner ultimate title to that land. It's not allowed. It's the law of the land that you can't sell land to a foreigner because it's got to remain land of the people of America. Now, you can sell the use of the land to the foreigner, but you cannot sell, you cannot give them ultimate title. And maybe another way to say that is allodial title. Basically, every country in the world, you go in there as a foreigner, you're under tremendous limits of what land you can buy. You go to Mexico, you cannot buy any of the coastal lands. They will not sell it to you. You have to go into, because they save that prime land for sale to their own people. And I'm sure that if you do buy land in the center of Mexico and you misbehave, they will take the land away from you and send you home to your birth state. In Nebraska, the land is under land patent. In many areas of the country, it's under land grant. Land grants are easier to cancel the ability for the county to tax land or to evidence the authority to tax land. It's a little bit harder in land patent areas. And my Nebraska land that I'm working on right now is in a Nebraska area. So tomorrow I'll be ordering a land patent on that, and I'm going to be turning it over to basically a professional that has been doing this for many years and removing, I think it was up to $30 billion of land. Essentially off the tax rolls in America thus far. They never reveal their name to other people. And they work in pretty relatively large numbers so that if the government decides to arrest some of them or kill some of them, that it's not going to be thwarted because there's too many people with the knowledge and are active in that organization. Very interesting. When they meet, they have to do it in a protective sense. And I was at one of the meetings, and they were contacted that a laser was being aimed at the windshield or the window by a car a quarter mile away, either a quarter mile or half mile away. So it was a very high-tech listening device that was aimed at that meeting. And I'm sure it's, you know, that was some time back, and I'm sure that almost every police department in America probably has that device now. It's not so high-tech. Your kids can probably get it for Christmas, somewhat similar device. We talked about Texas being a unique state. I've been down here in Texas for 5 or 6 months. I haven't seen a car pulled over getting a citation down here yet. It is amazing. The people drive fast, but safely. you get on a highway, it says 55. The people are going 90, 95. Not all of them, but some of them. And nobody is getting a ticket. I just don't understand it. I'm sure if you get really stupid and really fast, they're gonna chase you down and give you a handsome ticket. But I've been here 6 months. I haven't seen a car pulled over getting a citation yet. I'm traveling on these roads that are, the people are going, let's see, 50, 67, 89. They're going 35 miles an hour over the speed limit, 35, 40 miles an hour over the speed limit, and they're not getting pulled over. But those are on, you know, pretty wide open roads and safe to drive that fast if you're a reasonable driver. You know, these cars are very, very capable of accelerating and stopping safely at those speeds. Now, when I was in Nebraska, I would be there. I would take one trip between Lincoln and Nebraska, and I would, on a regular basis, I would count at least five people being pulled over getting a ticket every time I travel that road. And usually it's five people one direction and five people on the way back. Incredible. I remember one time I took a trip from Nebraska, Omaha, Nebraska to Washington State. Didn't see anybody pulled over. Got back to Nebraska, drove that on that interstate between Omaha and Nebraska. It's called I-80. Again, five people or so were pulled over getting tickets. Crazy. They love writing tickets there. And what I'm telling you is that the free state of Texas, they've realized that, you know, let the people drive the speed they want to drive, providing it's safe. And it seems to work quite well. You get into town, people are driving slow. But you get out on the highways around here, they're moving really fast. I'm looking down my list here. The land that the United States does hold is always held in trust. The United States does not hold land in ultimate title. That is held by the people. Now, the people have allowed the United States and its subdivision states to own 25% of the American soil for government purposes. Now, I probably would agree if a person would argue that that is way too much land. I think it is. It's way too much land. They don't need that land. They don't need that land. You could easily allow the American people to utilize that land, and everybody would be better off. But the Constitution of the United States says that the United States can only own land for military purpose. Now, where in the world is Yellowstone National Park for military purpose? I would guess that if you studied that, Yellowstone National Park is actually owned by a corporation. It's not even owned by the United States, because it would be a violation of the Constitution to do that. Okay, looking at my list here, sitting here on a boat in the dark, got a flashlight on my paper, and I know why I can't read it. I don't have my reading glasses on. Let me see if I can find my reading glasses. There they are. That explains why they're blurry. It's interesting that Michael talked about suing the title company when you asked them to investigate if there's any, if the title's clear. And they do all the investigation except going all the way back to make sure that the United States doesn't own an interest in the land. I was talking to an individual that had knowledge about establishing locations for Walmart, and they said that they never begin building any Walmart unless they have a land patent on the entire area. They will not build a Walmart unless they have evidence of a land patent, chain of title, starting with a land patent. If there is no land patent, the United States owns it. Simple as that. I went to the Bureau of Land Management. I said, what's the issue with a land patent if you can't find a land patent? He says, if we cannot find a land patent in this office, that means the United States owns it. And that's pretty interesting. It's by default, they own it. In the Louisiana Purchase, we're talking about the Louisiana Purchase here. It doesn't mean they own all the land without a land patent, but as far as the Louisiana Purchase goes. Okay, I talked about the first Constitution. That is definitely very telling. I remember visiting with an individual that did research on the second constitutions in Washington State, and they said that they actually had the first constitutions hidden in the archives, and he was able to get in there and find them. And he took pictures of them, and they were very disturbed that he found them and got pictures of them, of the original Constitution, because they wanted to get that. And then also the United States Constitution. I can't remember which portion of the Constitution of the Bill of Rights that did not allow the Bar Association to operate on American soil. It said something about, I think, the operation of esquires or something like that. And somebody broke into the Capitol during the War of 1812, I think, and burned the Capitol down and that original Constitution. And then after that, they traveled to all the states and they tried to confiscate all the copies of that original Constitution because it gave evidence that esquires were not allowed to operate on American soil. And if you ever noticed the bar attorney license, he likes to sign his name as esquire because that's what they are. They're operating in an occupation that has been barred, just like slavery has been barred in America. It's illegal to kidnap somebody. It's illegal to be a bar association. It's pretty amazing. Michael, you have any questions popping up with people?
Well, we have to invite them. Press *2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand on a board that I'm looking at, and I'll be happy to unmute you. Press *2. There's George. Okay. And those of you on Freedoms Radio, simply look to the center of your monitor. You silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side, and it's empty. Left click inside of it, type away your comment or question. On the outside of that rectangle, you'll see a place to put your contact information, then hit submit, and I'll read and give voice to your comment or question. Again, press *2 on your keypad to raise your hand. So we'll start with George. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, PJ, I've got a question on credit cards. We talked about this a little bit before, but I'm just currently at a position where I've finally run out of the ability to get more credit, so I'm going to have to stop paying the credit cards. And I'm just wondering, what is the best way to respond, you know, over time as they go through the process they do when people stop paying? Like, do I phone them, tell them I'm not paying? Do I make any explanation? Do I just ignore resentments? How would you suggest going through that process as they go through all their stages of, putting me in default and
if you,
and all that?
Let's just say you had a $10,000 credit card and you just stopped paying on it. They'll wait about a year and a half, and they'll sell the debt. The bank will sell the debt to a debt collector for usually about, I think it was 14 or 16%, something like that. I used to know what the norm was. And then they would come after you, but they would come after you under the bank name. And but anyway, you just wait till that debt collector contacts you, and then you contact us, and we'll show you how to challenge that properly so that they pretty much know. I've never lost a credit card case. The people I work with have never lost a credit card case, Michael's group. They bug out. We had an individual that was a lawyer, and he would buy this debt for 14.5% from these banks. And he was telling one of our people, he didn't know that we were heavily involved in helping people prevail in credit card debt cancellation. But and he just said, he told a friend of mine, he said, I pay 14.5% on these debts. And he says, if anybody challenges me, I let it go, because I don't want any of this revealed that I'm paying 14.5% on these debts. He doesn't want a whole bunch of other people getting in line and paying more than 14.5% for him. It's probably one thing he's afraid of. Also, if he pays,
once in the past, you said something about once they start calling you, you ask them for their bond. They have to have a bond to perform. And then there was another question you said you asked them that sort of causes them to
I don't know if they have to have a bond. I just don't know.
Oh, okay. Maybe that wasn't you that said that.
No. The main question that you ask them you claim to have authority to collect this debt. Did you purchase this debt? Who's the holder of this debt? What was it purchased for? When was it purchased? How was it purchased? Why was it purchased? You know, who, what, when, where, how, why? You just scare the heebie-jeebies out of him that somebody's going to be testifying that because it's illegal. If a credit card claim started out at $10,000 plus interest, let's just say it's $10,000 for easy math, and then it goes up for sale, and the guy pays $1,450. And 10% of 10,000 is what?
That's right.
$1,400. Yeah, $1,450. So he only paid $1,450 for it, but he's going into bank trying to get $10,000 from you. That's fraud. He can lose his bar license over that. He cannot sue for more than his out-of-pocket cost.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay,
George.
So, what about the fact that what about the fact that a contract is a two-party contract, and when a contract is sold, that it has to be with the permission of both parties? And if I didn't give permission, does that then just void the contract because it's been sold to another party and the contract is no longer valid?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Michael doesn't want to get us off topic tonight. This, you know, the credit card is a whole big topic in itself.
What I want to share with George is that the information provider that has gone more than 15 years without losing a single case, his name is Michael Maris. He's now completely retired. He doesn't want to even take my phone calls if I want to talk about credit card collection. If I want to wish him a happy birthday, hey, call him up, you know. But he doesn't want anything more to do with it. But anyways, he gave me the right to sell two pamphlets, two booklets of his that is a complete walkthrough on how to handle a third-party debt collector on one hand, and the other booklet is how to clean up your credit bureau report based upon the alleged debts that you may owe. And these are available. They're $600 or downloaded, and we just trust that you don't copy and share them. But that's what we offer. And I have another information provider that is not yet fully vested with me that will be coming on. His specialty is credit card collections, as was Michael Maris's. And he has a totally different technique and is all excited about what I shared with him in these two booklets. So we have people that are available to consult with you, but we want you to first get the booklet and read it and then reread it again and thoroughly use it. Once you have your instructions, you're going to you're going to dispute the debt is what you're going to do. Mm-hmm. And once you dispute the debt properly, according to the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, you're going to start a time clock that starts a time. And they have so much time to respond. If they fail to, if they make any collection efforts after that, you're keeping a notebook of every time they contact you from that point forward, whether it's mail, email, phone, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, 8 months, 10 months later, maybe a year later, and you've got this booklet now that's full, you'll sue them. Not for anything other than violations of the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and the Telephone Protection Act. Because once you set that tripwire, when you challenge the, you ask for them to verify the debt, and they didn't. Now they'll send you lots of stuff. They'll send you copies of statements. None of that measures up to verifying the debt. So you go to court in federal court. You'll go to federal court yourself. Federal court's a different place than state courts. Federal courts are very relaxed. They go by the rules. You're just as likely to see a judge dressed doing this court in his chambers, dressed in his golf clothes, and you know he's looking at his watch, waiting to stop everything, have lunch, and play golf for the afternoon. It's very relaxed. But the thing is that he'll sit there and he'll bring the court to order. He'll ask the defendant to tell his story, why he's there. And the first thing out of his mouth almost always is, "Your Honor, this is the plaintiff's attempt not to pay a debt owed to XYZ Bank or credit card company, mm-hmm. et cetera." And he'll talk on that for a few minutes, and the judge will say, "Okay, I've heard enough." Then he turns to you and says, why are we here?" And you're going to say, "Your Honor, first I want to apologize. The defendant is, I understood, to be a member of the bar, yet he did not read the complaint. The complaint has nothing to do with the purported debt that I may owe. It has everything to do with the collection processes wherein he violated the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and Telephone Protection Act. I'd like to enter into evidence this binder that I have that shows each and every violation, its date, and its proof of receipt by the either by mail or by the Sprint phone bill that I have or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this in an affidavit form, and I'd like to put this in the record. So the judge says, "No, let's just wait a second." And he'll turn to the defendant and says, "You know, the two of you need to settle this. Go outside in the hallway for 5 minutes and see if you can't come to an agreement." That's lawyer talk from one lawyer to another that I'm not ready to roll over you. I like the results. So do the best you can to negotiate what you can out in the hall. And at that point, it's game over with regards to the defendant, you know, getting anywhere with this. Now, he may be out there and saying, "All right, look, judge wants to come out here and to make an agreement. You owe my client $15,000 on this debt. I'll accept $7,500, or I'll accept $2,000, whatever it is." And your reply is something to like, "Well, you know, that all may be real, right, and true, and you may be correct, but why don't we just let a jury decide who's at fault here and who is, okay, let's still let a jury decide." And at that point there, you know, now you're negotiating. And because he knows that he may be looking at $40,000 worth of violations of these three different federal acts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I would encourage you, George, to get this, get back with me privately. I think you have my direct number. Sure. Is that correct?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Just get back with me. Let's get that booklet, those two booklets, in your hands, and then we can go from there.
Okay. Good. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anybody else, press star 2 on your keypad. We don't want to have an early call tonight. We've been going on in the past for another hour. Anybody else, press star 2 on your keypad. While you're thinking about pressing that button, I'm going to go over to Freedoms Radio and see if anybody's asking any questions there. Dun-dun-dun-dun-dun. Nope, not there. Not asking questions. Okay, maybe when I return, we'll have a question. No, that's it. PJ, I think you're going to get home early tonight.
Good, good. I got things to do tonight.
I know. Yeah, anybody else, press star 2 in your keypad. Let's make this a happy time. Wait a minute. Was that Gregory? Did you just, no, George, you did too. But Gregory, just a second. I clicked you off. Here you go. Thank you. Go ahead, Gregory.
Hey, everybody. I had a question, or actually, probably more of some advice. I'm in a situation where I'm in a house where it's been signed over to my trust by the original owner. I paid him to do a quitclaim deed. And shortly after that, I did a kind of payoff. He added me on the loan and got a payoff on the house and sent in an instrument to where I could to pay off. And after that, all hell broke loose because they assigned a real estate company to the house to try to take it back from me. So I had it where they I wasn't in the house. I was living in another house, and they went and changed the locks. I ended up changing the locks back. So they the real estate company called me to try to work something out with me, and I told him that I would. I guess he would want to pay me for whatever I had interest into the house, but he never got back with me, and he hired an attorney, and the attorney came after me to take the house. And so this has been going on since the latter part of last year, and I'm at a losing battle now because they did an emergency, the TRO, restraining order. Gave me 3 days to make it to court, and I did not make it to court within those 3 days. And now I'm at a writ of possession, signed off by the judge. Then I did a notice of removal in the federal court, and the notice got sent back to the state court. I have 14 days to reply back. The removal was not strong enough. I didn't have enough substance into the removal to have them to take the case. So I'm kind of stuck.
What's their claim for having right to take the property?
Well, they're saying on November the 2nd of 2021 that the house went into foreclosure. And, but I had already signed the house over to the trust. And, also I forgot that I took the deed and put it into my, all cap name private business trust and with the registered mail number.
So anyway, they're claiming an amount was due on the outstanding promissory note then. Michael, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I said that I had a conversation with him earlier today, and I invited him on the call to speak with you about that. And I said that with all that's transpired, with not starting a year ago, proactively in defense of this, that at this point in time, he's going to have to fight from behind to climb back into it, as opposed to be dealing with it straight up. But anyways, I just wanted to share that with you. That's all.
Yeah, you just have to talk to us and give us a call tomorrow or the next day, and we'll find out if you can throw a little money our way or whatever. Michael can work out a deal, and we can get a proper notice upon them to force them to produce the verified claim against you. They have to swear that they have authority to take this house administratively. They have to swear to that, and they may not have anybody that's willing to do that. So that's an angle that we'll start with there.
So what would generally happen after that? Do you default them, or what do I be looking at?
Essentially, it defaults them, and then We've done this before. The guy I work with has done this before, and they've had meetings because we knew somebody in the office, and they got back to us, and they told us that everybody in the office said that there's no way they can overcome this challenge. And they just walked away immediately. But that doesn't always happen. You know, some of them continue to fight. But anyway, you'll have to work out something with Michael on the so that we can get paid for our time, I guess.
Sure.
Right.
All right. Very good. Anyone else? Press star 2. I think I saw George had his hand raised a moment ago. Let me see if he's still here. No, I think he left the call. All right. Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. We had a great time. Would like to have had a longer, greater time, but we didn't. So, but we're here. Next week, remember to join us Saturday with Judge Bernie regarding the ultimate in asset protection, how to get to a place where you're judgment proof, where even if you get a judgment against you, there's nothing that they can take because you own nothing. You control everything. Think of Magnum PI. And then on kind of Monday, what you heard tonight on tonight's call was regards to your status in the courts, how they violate that, because you are, without correcting your status, you are a federal citizen, and they can do what they want with you, literally. Learn Monday night how we can go about correcting your status. And correcting your status is different from changing your status. Many people are saying, well, I want to change my status. No, you don't. Your status should have been corrected from the beginning. When you say you want to change your status, what you're saying is that it was right before, but something changed in the way that you are today, so you need to change your status today. No, this is correcting the status. They got it wrong from the day they processed your birth certificate from the Bureau of Vital Statistics in the state that you were born in, and then they forwarded that to the State Department of the United States, and the State Department of the United States just said, federal citizen, another one. And that's where they put you and kept you, and that's why they've gotten away with all that they've done with you, requiring licenses and requiring paying taxes and things like that that are not their right to do so, citizen of one of the states, several states. So join us Monday night for that call, and I guess that's about the end of tonight. Until then, good night, everybody, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.